This episode is brought to you by Square. If you run a restaurant or business, Square has the tools to help you stay connected to customers, shift your business, and navigate this uniquely challenging time. Learn more at square.com/go/industry. This week on Meet and Three, we're turning our attention to how the global pandemic is impacting our mental health and how food brings us comfort during these times.
I've never understood why people have said I'm brave for solo dining.
Food can kind of be a source of solace, or it can be a source of excitement, or like an activity to keep you busy.
When there's a crisis, typically the restaurant industry is one of the industries that springs into action in terms of being like, well, come in, we'll take care of you.
Tune in to Meet and Three to learn more about the psychological effects of COVID-19, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, hello. Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and it is Wednesday, June 17th, 2020. This is the 255th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talent in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is a wonderful chef and finalist from Bravo's Top Chef, and I will introduce him fully in a moment. First, as I do in every show, I will start out with my PR tip. And then later, we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, which is a takeout experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip off the show with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to speak your truth. Always stand for what you believe in and take pride in who you are and where you came from. Know that your realness and authenticity will not only be recognized and appreciated, but inspiring to others. By standing for our principles, we can be role models and advocates for change and the better good. So let's use our platforms and our voices to make a difference and lead by example with our truth. That's my tip today. Now, I'm really thrilled to have my guest on the show with me. It is Eric Ajapong. He is the chef and co-founder of Pinch and Plate and On the Double, a new restaurant soon to open in Washington, D.C.'s Union Market, showcasing the African diaspora. Eric was a finalist on Bravo's Top Chef Season 16, where he earned consistent acclaim, introducing viewers to traditional Ghanaian cuisine, and he recently returned as a contestant on Top Chef All-Stars Season 17. So hi, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Sherry, what's going on? It's good to hear from you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining me. I'm really excited to chat and hear more about...
Me too.
Yeah, hear more about everything that you're up to and your background and just how you got into cooking. So why don't we start with a little of the history. Like, I believe you grew up in New York City. And is that correct?
Yeah, I grew up in New York City. I just do have to say, though, that PR tip was really, really great. I love that. Speaking your truth, especially right now, is so important. So I did love that tip, a little tidbit right there. But yeah, New York City kid. I'm a first generation American, Ghanaian American. My folks came here to the States in the late 80s and had me and then my younger brothers. So I very much grew in a very traditional West African home, but also, you know, a regular New York City kid at the same time. So that dichotomy, especially for my passion and what I fell in love with, was awesome. Yeah, I was able to not only, you know, eat the foods of, you know, my background and, you know, growing up eating traditional West African food, fufu and jollof and kenke and everything in between, but then also having the really cool luxury of eating in, you know, a Puerto Rican neighborhood or, you know, a Dominican neighborhood or a West Indies or Caribbean neighborhood. They were all, or Jewish or Italian, they were all around me in the Bronx. So I was very fortunate in that regard, especially, you know, now looking back in retrospect.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's great. You had that, the diversity. And then how did you get into what inspired you to want to be a chef and go to cooking school?
It was really, I always tell the story, it's kind of a joke now, but I grew up watching cartoons and cooking shows. I fell in love watching Julia Childs and Yan Can Cook on PBS, and I really just had a strong affinity to cooking. I thought it was just cool at a young age, around 6 or 7, really young. And my mom also saw that within me and just thought it was interesting that I was watching little, cooking shows for adults as a kid. And she always encouraged me to watch alongside her as she cooks in the kitchen. And same thing with, my other family members, my uncles were great cooks as well. So that really was the spark, I think. And then I came to that pivotal moment, honestly, during high school. You had that conversation with your guidance counselor, and for me, it was like she asked, "What do you want to do?" And I always kind of told her about my love for food and culinary arts. And at that point, I figured I wouldn't be a professional football player at that moment, so I kind of transitioned into something a little bit more within my suite, I feel like. And she nurtured it, she encouraged it. She transferred me into this really cool vocational school during high school. So I would, out of the 9 periods of high school, I would leave for 5 of them to go out to another location. It was called BOCES, and they would train students, whether it be, different technical stuff. So cosmetology, mechanics, culinary arts. And that's, for me, was my first experience in a professional kitchen. And I loved it. I fell in love with it and, decided to pursue it as my bachelor's in school and everything else. And kind of all those chips kind of fell from there.
Yeah. And you also, beyond a culinary arts and culinary nutrition degree from Johnson & Wales, you went on to get an international public health nutrition degree.
Yeah.
Which yeah. I think that might be a first for a guest on my show. what motivated you to go in that direction? Yeah. With tying in nutrition to cooking?
It was, I know it's, I don't, that this maybe, oh, geez, 2 other chefs, honestly, that I know that have a degree in public health or anything like that. So, I knew when I was going to embark on this, it would also help me set myself apart from my story and what I'm trying to do. It's always kind of come back to me, when you know better, you do better. And I was always encouraged to continue learning, whether it be from my parents or anyone in my family. It was around 2012, early 2012, I came to a really pivotal crossroads. As far as my career, and having the opportunity to go and work for Brian Voltaggio at Vault Restaurant, and going to England and studying for my master's degree. I stodged and I worked for a couple of days in the restaurant, and I was officially offered the job, but I remember Brian actually, Chef, calling me. And we had a great conversation, and he encouraged me to follow my heart and follow what I thought was best. And around the same time, I had a cousin that lived in England that was studying for her law degree. And she just kind of threw it out there. She's like, "How crazy would it be if you came to England and study for your master's?" And at first I was like, "God, that's silly. Why would I do that?" And it really just kind of rolled itself into itself. And it became an idea that got bigger and bigger. And I think that time when I had a conversation with Chef Brian, again, he encouraged me, although I had a great opportunity to work with somebody that I really, really admired. I had all his books. I watched him on Top Chef and everything in between. But I'm very glad, I made that decision way back when, because it's kind of crazy now that a few years later, 8 years later or so, having the opportunity to compete against him, in Top Chef is pretty cool.
I know, it's like full circle for sure.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's very cool. So then you started your own business. You started Pinch and Plate along with your wife. Was this I mean, was this what motivated that decision? And was it, were you coming from working in some kitchens prior, or were you doing it simultaneously?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I got back from England studying for my, once I finished studying, and I moved back to New York. And around the same time, my now girlfriend, she moved, Janelle, just moved to New York from DC, just accepting a new job with the FDA. And she has always kind of been into interior designing. Her father is a carpenter. Her grandfather is as well. And it's just kind of in her blood. So she had bought a home in DC at a very young age, and she needed to furnish it. And she did so herself and, you know, blogged it and really created a strong following just by, you know, doing it herself and causing a lot of inspiration for a lot of people. So when she moved there, I didn't know any of this. It was unbeknownst to me when we were dating. But when we did get together, she had asked me to do a dinner for her and her girlfriends in New York. And she wanted to obviously show off her culinary boyfriend skills. But, you know, unbeknownst to me, when I was prepping for the event, for the dinner, I remember leaving the kitchen, turning the corner, and I could see how like beautifully decked out she made the table, and with the tablescapes and the candelabras and the flowers, and it was just gorgeous. So we kind of had a eureka moment, you know, simultaneously. We thought that, you know, with her skills and my skills, kind of pairing it together would be a cool thing, and seeing if we can maybe do it mobile. And we came up with the idea and the name Pinch and Plate. She's the pinch, the detail, and plate comes from me. And really we ran with it, and we had a lot of fun, you know, in New York, building our clientele and, you know, getting really attention from a few publications early on, which was really cool. So yeah, it's been awesome. It's been awesome. We obviously, everything was happening with COVID, and prior to that, it's just, it got to be a lot as far as just us two doing all of the work, you know, because it first started off as that dinner party, but then it graduated to, like, you know, bigger dinner parties and graduations and milestone birthdays and weddings. And so looking into doing like a model where people can come to us rather than us going to them is what we're focused on right now. So yeah, but it was really cool. It was a great experience kind of building that, and, you know, my relationship with my wife now.
Yeah, and that's great. I didn't know that's how the name came about either. and were you, with your services or the type of food you were doing, was it, you know, was it only focusing on West African cuisine, or was it across the globe catering to whatever your clients' tastes were?
It was across the globe. I think it first started off as across the globe type thing, and then the more people found out about what I can do and, you know, what I was doing with food of like the West African diaspora, the more it was requested during events and stuff like that. So but yeah, it was really a combination of all things. Honestly, I can mix up, do more like classic modern American, or, you know, anything that's just like West African focused, or Latin American, a lot of the stuff that I was just trained and comfortable in cooking. So, yeah.
Yeah. I have to ask too, because I mean, I've been in New York since 98, so I was here when you were here, but I didn't, mm-hmm. I'm sorry I didn't get to meet you back then. But what restaurants in New York did you work at? I probably dined at them.
yeah. Oh man, I was, when I got back from Johnson & Wales, I worked in a restaurant called Union Market, right in, it's not called Union Market's in DC. It was called Nuella in near Union Station. What is that? What, I forget. I
Grand haven't Central? Been
in DC or in Grand, no, Grand, not Grand Central, but 14th
Penn
Street.
Station?
No. Oh my gosh, I feel so embarrassed. It's 14th Street downtown.
Union Square.
Union Square, there you go. It just slipped me. I'm thinking of Union Station here in DC, and now my wires have crossed, and I've officially lost my New York card. But I worked around there at a spot called Nuella. for some time. And then I moved over to Marc Forgione. I worked in his restaurant for some time right before I moved to England. And then also Rouge Tomat, that was over on the east side.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that closed down for some time.
I was right. I have dined at those places. And they're I mean, their Marc is great, and Rouge Tomat, what they were doing is very, very, very really cool. Yeah, I could see why you'd been drawn to work there. Mm-hmm. So what led you to audition for a Top Chef, or who submitted your resume for you?
You know, it's so funny. I've always been a fan of the competition show. I thought it was just brilliant. You know, the first times I started watching and being a really just enthusiastic kid in undergrad and culinary school, and kind of clearing out my schedule to watch Top Chef was pretty cool. It was an event for me. So I remember telling my wife now, during our first date, our literal first date, how big of a fan I was of Top Chef. And, you know, she had gone and encouraged me. She's like, hey, have you applied? And I was like, nah, I don't think I can ever, you know, make it on or anything like that. So she did it for me. And it was pretty cool. They were doing like almost like a nationwide tour. I'm going to different cities, just trying out different foods from different chefs. And they landed in DC, and I cooked for them, and I made them a curry corn bisque, and with some salmon and cockle clams and some pickled mushrooms. And they apparently loved it. And they reached back out, not too long after, but it was crazy. This was during actually season 15. I was on season 16, and so this is the Denver season, and it was nuts because I had made it all the way to almost like the last round of casting when I found out that the first day of filming was going to be on my wedding day. So needless to say,
wow.
yeah, May 21st, 2017. It was nuts. Like, we did our best to try to like maneuver and make things happen, but they were like, nah, we can't move the date. So we stayed in contact, honestly, throughout the year, and just great things happened. I just kept on building the story I really had towards myself. Ended up started working at Kith and Kin as well, and when the next round, season 16, came, they announced that they were casting. They reached out to me, and really we picked up from, you know, the last where we left off. And I was just thankful that I was able to have that opportunity again.
Oh, wow. I had no idea. That's so cool.
Yeah,
I was
crazy.
Thinking, I mean, I wonder if you've given this thought, or I was thinking, like, I wonder what it would have been like if you were on season 15 and competing
against
you know, those chefs versus 16. And, but that's really cool that you got that opportunity, and you know, the next season later. And I mean, what was your experience like, or the biggest takeaways? Because I can't imagine what it's like to be on that show. It's I think it's much harder than people think.
Yeah, it's tough. It's you know, I knew that though. I think just I've been kind of I guess, unofficially been studying the show for so long. I just, you know, I've seen so many episodes and kind of know the rigor. And I would imagine, just even besides what I've noticed on TV, I just had an understanding of it being difficult. And, you know, growing throughout my career and having the opportunities to come across some chefs that actually went ahead and competed, you know, getting some like really valuable intel on, you know, what to expect and, you know, everything in between, I knew I had to brace myself for something that was going to be the biggest challenge, I think. And it was. So I think, to be honest, Sherry, it was really going in with that mindset that this is going to be very, very, very hard, made it very easy for me, if that made sense. Like, I was braced for it. I was ready to, I say this all the time, I was ready to break down and, you know, a whole pig with a paring knife if they asked me to. Like, I was ready for the craziest things to be thrown at me. And I think that really kind of that mindset, really relinquishing control, allowed me to really just go with whatever flow that they had. I think it was a great mentality to be in for my season. I try to go in with the same mentality season 17 as well. But it was tough. I mean, regardless of the fact, your mindset and everything else, you still have to execute. You still have to perform and put out interesting flavors and tell great stories behind your food. And technique needs to be there. And, you know, all of these things are all encompassing. Not to mention that you have a camera right in front of your face. So, it was tough, but it was also one of the most rewarding things I think I've ever done in my life.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's incredible. I've really enjoyed watching you. It's made me want your food so badly, seeing what you've cooked. and you're so natural on camera. You're very, you know, it's great to watch you, and you make it seem so easy, or I can't, with a camera in your face and then all these chefs running around, and also from being on All Stars, where you're competing with people at, you know, who've been on the show, who are obviously All Stars. That's gotta be even trickier, harder. But also then maybe knowing as a second season, knowing a little bit about what to expect or not to expect.
True. Yeah. Yeah. That was interesting too. I mean, the first time around, it's tough. And thank you for that. The editing, I think, does a great job of making me look good. The first season, the season 16 for me was tough. You're new, you're green behind the ears. You don't really know what TV life is like, and recording and then also competing was different. But like you mentioned, everyone coming back for All Stars, we'd either done it the second time or third time around, honestly. Everyone kind of had that understanding under their belt, knew the rigor, knew what the kind of the field and the competition and what life was like outside of the camera was like. So I think that really played into, different advantages during different competitions and different challenges and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was harder second time around for sure. Definitely harder. The competition itself is steeper, but then the challenges itself were crazy. And then not to mention, I think what they did a really great job was the judges all throughout the season. I remember seeing Marcus Samuelson for like the first competition, the first, like very first episode. I'm like, oh my goodness, like what do we have in store if this is what, you know, we have to feed? So just really bringing the best palettes across the nation and to the show while still, you know, having Tom as the judge, and his palette is just remarkable. It was, there's not a lot of wool you can pull over the eyes of the judges as far as your food is concerned. So it's revealing, but it is also a growing moment too. I don't think I've ever grew so quickly and so deeply in my career, and being around such great chefs, that one is pretty cool. But then also being critiqued, and then also listening to other criticisms, whether I was in the high, middle, or low, I always listened and picked up on what the judges liked on everybody's dish and what they didn't like for everybody's dish. And I think that also helped me become a more well-rounded chef.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've always been a fan of Top Chef for many reasons, but I think their editing, there's the whole way they put the show together, the expertise of the judges, and the diversity, bringing people on. Actually I was thinking a few weeks ago I had on restaurateur Kevin Boehm on my show, who was one of the judges when you were on. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. It's a great show. It's a great experience, and I think it's so nice that, you know, you got that visibility of being a part of it. What's happening now with On the Double? Let's talk a little about your future restaurant and what's happening in this strange time we're in.
It's very strange indeed. I was very much excited, still am, still very much excited to open up. My initial thoughts were to do so for the spring. And then like a week after I announced, everything just kind of collapsed, and we were, everything that started as the new normal kind of began. So It's been interesting, you know, but I am very, very much lucky to, you know, as lucky as I can be, I can say, just knowing that some of my colleagues and good friends are in more disadvantaged, you know, situations where they actually are opened and or were open and have to figure out, you know, what to deal with, you know, fired staff or let go staff and everything in between. So it is a challenge, but I'm still very much looking forward to opening On the Double. It'll be my first public restaurant in Union Market in DC. And really, it's the concept is celebrating the African diaspora through the lens of a roti shop. I love roti, and the double itself is a Indian Trinidadian dish that is just like a classic street food. And I think pairing the two, understanding the dichotomy between the West Indies and the Caribbean and African cultures, I thought was always very interesting, especially again growing up in New York. And all of our kind of communities living together as one, so to speak. So kind of bridging that and bringing some really authentic Caribbean and West African diaspora flavors to the shop. I'm very much excited for it. So when it comes out and I can actually get back in the market and open up, I'll be really, really happy to serve people. And yeah, very much look forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it too. I a few years ago, I worked with a restaurant in Brooklyn called Streets that showcased foods from around the world, and they had doubles on the menu, and it was the first time I had it.
I love it.
I remember sitting down with the owner who was from the Caribbean and saying, like, couldn't believe I had never had this, but like showing me how to eat it, and it was so delicious. So it's like now I feel I know it. I'm craving it, but it's not something I had ever seen before, you know.
No, I love it. I think that's what's going to be most exciting too. It's a very unfamiliar kind of vessel for a lot of food, but it's such a delicious kind of it's so customizable. You can throw literally whatever kind of condiment or curry or chutney or whatever it is that you want, you know, that tastes good to you. So I'm really excited to have people kind of come in and mix up and mash up their own kind of preference and celebrate a little bit of a cuisine that they may not be familiar of, and you know, be encouraged to go back and actually try a traditional one and everything in between. So I'm really happy for that.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. What's the status right now in DC with restaurant openings? I've been to Union Market before, yeah. So I know it's, you know, like a, well, it's a cool, it's hard to, it's not like a,
yeah,
a food hall, but it's kind of, it's a market. I don't know, it's more than that.
Yeah, it's kind of a little bit in between though. You're right. It's a little funky that way. It's a food hall. It has markets in there too. It's just a very unique space, but also one of DC's most like traffic busy, most kinetic energy happening, a lot of tourism, a lot of folks that just live in walking distance of the area. It's a very popular space out here in the district. So it's been just a wait. I know DC's phase two is supposed to be happening, I believe tomorrow, where they're allowing restaurants to open up capacity, I believe by 50%, and allowing some other small businesses and I guess non-essentials now to start opening up for business. So I'm hopeful for that. I think really I can't say necessarily what's going on with the market 1,000%. I just know that just how big it is. 50% is still a lot of people to hold in that one venue. So they're doing the best that they can, just speaking with them as often as possible, just knowing that safety is first. You know, they want to make sure that they keep everyone protected. Even the folks that are working right now and doing like delivery and takeout, they have them in mind to just keep them protected, keep them safe, and really just take all precautionary measures. It's going to be tough though until a vaccine happens though.
Yeah, no, totally. I'm thinking the market, they have a big outdoor area too, which is good.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
So, yeah, but it's tough times, but I hope you can get open soon and serving your food, and I can get back down to DC.
I am too. Yeah, it would be a great reason for you to come down and
it really would.
That'd be awesome. I can't wait.
Me too. So before we take a break, let me ask you my question from my last guest. On episode 254, I had on John Weissman. He is the founder of Curious Elixirs, which is a non-alcoholic craft drinks company. And he wants to know, what's the best way to inspire the youth of America to form a connection with their food and where it comes from? How do we create that connection and help foster it?
That is a great question. I think it really starts with a serious education. I think introducing food and food culture at a young age in a curriculum base that helps explain where we are as a country, who we are as a country, the strides that we've taken to eradicate certain things and elevate certain things as well. I think a great example of that is just what happened today, where PepsiCo and Quaker decided to no longer run or discontinue, rather, the Aunt Jemima brand. I grew up looking at Aunt Jemima, and, you know, for years and years and years, and understanding the racial implications behind it, but still knowing it to be somewhat of an American kind of classic or staple, just offering a strong Americana. And understanding why, you know, and I think those things like that, and understanding who we are and why certain things are happening, and why certain corporations and, you know, making the strides that they are, you can kind of see it all over, especially right now. So I think a strong education is probably the best way to do that. I don't know if that was a long-winded answer, but I hope that made sense.
Yeah, it was a great answer, and yeah, it was a good question. My guests usually ask the best questions, so
that was a pretty good one.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's take a little break, and then we're gonna come back, and we'll play my speed round game. We'll talk some industry news. We'll have my solo dining takeout experience, and the final question. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by Square. We all know that this is an incredibly challenging time for our friends running restaurants and small food businesses. With social distancing in place, people are staying home and eating in, and restaurants have had to pivot to pickup and delivery only. HRN would usually be recording our podcast from our studio inside Roberta's, but since they've had to close their dining room, they've ramped up their frozen pizza production, set up a wine and grocery shop, and seen their delivery orders skyrocket. Like Roberta's, many restaurants have been changing offerings day by day as they figure out how to best serve their customers. If you run a restaurant or a small business, Square has the tools to help you adapt. One of these tools is the Square Online Store. It lets you set up a free online ordering page with curbside pickup and local delivery so you can keep customers safe. You can deliver orders yourself or integrate with delivery partners. Its order hub lets you manage all your incoming orders in one place, no matter which delivery partners you choose to use. Square has all the tools to help you stay connected to customers no matter where they are. See everything that's available by visiting square.com/go/industry.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and my guest today is Eric Ajapong. He is the chef and owner of Pinch and Plate and On the Double, and he's also a finalist from Bravo's Top Chef Season 16, which was in Kentucky, and a competitor on Bravo's Top Chef All-Star Season 17, which was in Los Angeles. So it's time for my speed round game. Eric, what this is I'm going to name a couple things, and you get to pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla.
All right. Ready? I'm bracing myself. I'm ready.
All right.
Let's do it.
Born ready. Here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Eat in.
Wine, beer, cocktail, mocktail, or champagne?
Oh, a cocktail.
All right. How about tasting menu or a la carte?
A tasting menu.
Small plates or large plates?
Mmm. small plates.
It's a long
Yeah, I might go back on that one, actually. I'm thinking, oh gosh, that's a tough one. I'm going to go large plates. I feel like I've been touching that. Large plates. I'll do that. It's a switch.
All right. I'm like, I love how people take this so seriously. I'll hold you to it. Large plates now. Okay. How about communal table or chef's counter?
That's so funny. Communal table.
It is. It's like you got to. It's very
it's like
important.
Life and death,
gotta,
right.
It yeah. really is. Really is. Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
All-inclusive.
How about teaching cooking on camera via Zoom or cooking in a competition on TV?
I like the Zoom, but it's not as much pressure. Yeah, not as much pressure.
Yeah, but you're doing that a lot now. That's like... the new normal.
Yeah, it's been the new normal. It has been. It's been awesome, though. I've been teaching classes in New York and DC and Baltimore. So now to kind of bring it on a virtual platform and be able to not only be like held to the folks that just live in that city, but really to do a class and have folks from, you know, all over the place. I had a class where there was people from Saudi Arabia and California and like where else? It was Ghana. It was really, really cool, Sherry. I mean, it was awesome. It was mind blowing that so many people across the world wanted to take their time and cook together. So it's become really, really fun. And I love it.
That's really cool. Yeah, for sure. Okay, I have a few more. Kentucky or Los Angeles?
Ooh, LA.
Cheese plate or dessert?
Dessert all day.
Dessert all day. And the last one is Manhattan, Brooklyn, or I'll say DC.
That's an easy one. I gotta say with Manhattan.
Manhattan. Well, glad. Good to know. And that's the game. You win. Everyone's a winner.
I win.
It's fun to hear how people get stuck on certain things and take it seriously. So for industry news, I picked out an article that was in the New York Times, and the title is "The Quote Unquote Poisoned Shake Shack Milkshakes and an NYPD on Edge." Claims that fast food workers poisoned officers intentionally proved to be unfounded. But the ensuing uproar underscored a tense new dynamic. And this was by Edgar Sandoval. Did you see this piece? And did you see this whole thing unfold the other night? Because I was watching along,
you know,
and it became a huge news story. Go ahead.
It was pretty nuts. I think I caught wind of it last night as well, and I don't know how to react. I don't think if there is an investigation, and I think things remain to be unfounded, I think that's a good thing. And hopefully it was just maybe like a lapse in mechanical or some sort of equipment error or whatever like that. But I truly hope there isn't anyone maliciously trying to potentially hurt, anyone because of their profession. I think obviously in the times that we're in right now and people feeling very sensitive towards racial issues and police treatment and seemingly their power that they have when it comes to policing Black people specifically, they become more sensitive and hopefully not retaliating in a way that can really affect their future in the long run. So I hope people just think about it. Again, I hope it is unfounded, but I really do hope that that's nothing serious. But it does, I think, ultimately shed a light on, I think, what the article is really trying to focus on. And, a police officer's kind of plight during these times and, what happens to that police officer when they take their uniform off and, how do they feel then? And there's a lot. I think I wish I had all the answers. to how people feel. And it's very hard to talk in a monolithically, but people are hurting, people are vocalizing that, people are emoting. I really, really do hope that there's significant change, longstanding change, and people don't quickly forget about these times. And because we tend to be fickle with a lot of things, especially with the news and things becoming, the breaking news almost every 2 seconds and 24-hour news being huge. So a lot of information is coming in and out, not to mention what's happening, on social media and online. But with all that said, the feeling that African Americans have and Black people have in general is a legitimate one towards just overall treatment and racism, I feel like, towards this country. And I think just with the unfortunate incidents that's happened in Minnesota, it's just been it's been trying time, for our country. But I'm really hoping some good comes from all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's been a difficult time period with the pandemic, and then with yeah, everything definitely. Unfolding with the protests. And I think this story, or just just give what happened. There were 3 police officers in New York City that got some milkshakes at Shake Shack in Lower Manhattan, and they were drinking them. They started to not feel well, and they thought there was something toxic in them, maybe some bleach, and I don't know. All of a sudden, Twitter exploded with this news, and the next day, it did come out that by the NYPD that they said Shake Shack employees haven't been found of doing any wrongdoing, and perhaps it was just something maybe with their dishwasher or something with, yeah. I don't know, their protocol that there was the whatever the shakes keep had some toxic thing in them. I think they're still investigating, but yeah. I don't think there was any malicious intent at all. But it's like, as you're saying, it's people are on the edge right now. And, it was just seeing this story and how it got picked up on all the news channels. And then also as thinking about knowing Shake Shack and knowing, people, knowing Danny Meyer and people behind it, thinking, I mean, having a restaurant, having multiple restaurants, I mean, we've talked about this, like consistency and how things can just, you're only, maybe only as good as your last meal. And it's like,
exactly.
Shows how hard it is to run a restaurant and a whole chain. I mean, there were just this whole, everything just got me thinking about a lot of stuff. And I do, I'm hoping, I think change is necessary for our society. And, it's a very trying time, but I'm hopeful for the future.
I am as well. Sure. Yeah, for sure. I am as well.
So, yeah, I don't know. In New York, there's been a lot of protests. I think they're still going on. I've been a part of some of them, and it's been very peaceful. And it's
good, great.
Yeah, it is good. So, anyways, I think I've also just back on this story. The police officers are apparently fine. There's
which is great.
There wasn't, I'm glad everyone's okay, and I hope we can, get through this and everything and avoid all these situations and just, try to just be good to each other and, I don't know. I'm lost for words a bit.
No, I mean, it is, it's hard to navigate through with words, we know how we feel. And sometimes, words escape when you're caught up with the emotion. I'm pretty sure, as you mentioned, being in a protest and what the emotions felt like over there. And, people are very much, trying to get a point across, people are tired, people are fed up, people are scared. And people just want to kind of live normal, and I think everyone deserves their right to that liberty and that freedom comfortably, you know, especially if they, honestly, if you've done anything wrong, your life shouldn't be taken away anyway. But if you should just walk comfortably from fear of retribution or retaliation from anyone that has hate or, you know, not fearing any cop that might, you know, at least seem as if they want to do you any harm. So I think, again, just people want to live free. People want to live comfortably. I think these protests are demonstrating that, you know, very much.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been eye-opening for me, and I want to be supportive and, do good for everyone. Everyone deserves to be treated fairly and equal rights.
Absolutely.
All right, so that was the news this week. I'm going to share my solo dining experience, which is my COVID version. It's a takeout experience, as I've been doing since this pandemic started. And this week it's from Contraire. So here's the rundown. The location, 138 Orchard Street, Lower East Side, New York City. The concept, a fun combination between the owner's two restaurants, Contra and Wild Air, hence the name Contraire, to fight the current COVID crisis. And the chefs and owners, who are they? Well, it's Jeremiah Stone and Fabian von Hosk. So why did I take out? Well, because I wanted to support these two chefs who I'm friends with, and they're super clever and fun, and they're great chefs, so I knew whatever I got would be delicious. So my experience, last Saturday I was biking around the city, as I tend to do these days. On a break, I stopped. I ordered off my phone through their website for a pickup about an hour later. I biked over there. They're on the Lower East Side, and the location is at Contra, where they're doing this Contraire menu. I was warmly greeted. I got my takeout, and I walked up to Tompkins Square Park in the East Village, which was actually quite busy. It was a beautiful day and there's lots of people out. But I found a park bench to sit and eat on, and that's where I enjoyed my meal. So what did I get? I had Jerry's Jerk Chicken, which is a barbecue grilled leg with pigeon pea rice and collard greens. And I also got their Dirt Cup, which is hazelnut chocolate pudding, hazelnut praline, and cocoa crumble. My take. Well, chicken was perfectly cooked, super flavorful, nice sides, fairly big portion, I would say. It was great. And the dessert was just divine. I mean, Fabian is like a chocolate king. I will eat his chocolate pudding any day. I would like to have it for dessert every night. It's really good. So the ambiance, as I said, it was a lively park during this kind of strange time. I mean, most people were wearing masks and social distancing, which is good. Perfect for enjoying a tasty meal that you may or may not cook yourself. Their menu has some things that I certainly don't usually cook myself, like tripe and crab congee. So maybe next time I'll get those. Interesting tidbit. So Contraire has extended their delivery map now to a 12-mile radius. So I am now in their zone. I wasn't initially when they started. And Jeremiah and Fabian also launched a shop called People's Wine, which is at the New Essex Market. It opened last year, and they're also open for delivery and pickup. Personal fun fact. So I met the chefs just from going to their restaurants and going to a lot of the same events that we were over the past few years, such as being at Aspen Food & Wine's Classic, where they were in the Best New Chefs class of 2016. And just a note, this weekend could be the Aspen Food & Wine's Classic, but they canceled it this year due to the pandemic. So hopefully to get back to that next year. The cost of my meal was $25. That's not including tax and gratuity. Would I go back? Yes. Their website is contraire.net. That's contraire.net. So there you go. Contraire.
That sounded great. Hazelnut sounded really nice. That delicious. That dessert.
Yeah, it's. I honestly, he's a savory chef, but he's, you know, his desserts are phenomenal, especially anything I've ever had, chocolate of his. big fan.
That's great.
So, yeah. Yeah, I was thinking, actually, when we were doing the speed round game, you said dessert. I'm thinking that's always seems like something on Top Chef that challenges the chefs when you have your dessert challenge.
You know, I kind of favor myself after Fabian, as I said, because I always have a couple of desserts. I fell in love with making desserts and pastry first before savory. So even though I am a savory chef, I can whip up a nice little dessert or two.
Yeah, well, I think for all purposes, that's great to have that skill set, but certainly for Top Chef, mm-hmm. it is.
Oh, of course, yes. Oh my goodness.
So, okay, so it's time for the final question. My next guest is Marissa Lippert. She is the chef and founder of Nourish Kitchen Table, which was formerly a West Village cafe and is now doing catering and private events. And she's also the chef and founder of Nourish Baby. So, Eric, can you please ask a question for Marissa?
Marissa, what has changed that you would keep once we kind of get back to normalcy after COVID is done? I'm wondering if there's anything that maybe implemented now that you probably will keep on for the future as you continue your business and grow it.
That's a great question. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I will find out. And yeah, it's interesting mm-hmm. that in this time that people are pivoting and making changes, like what's going to stick and what's going to not yeah. go back to whatever, however it was.
Exactly.
So terrific. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm, you know, we met in Philly, which now seems like forever
yes.
ago.
I know.
And I'm really glad that I know you now, and I can't wait to have your food, and I can't wait for you to open, and you're amazing. So I wish you continued success, and I'm ready for you to make me a double any day.
I can't wait, Sherry, as well. I know it's been great knowing you and getting to interact and speak to you now on a friendship level. So I'm very much appreciative of our bumping into each other in Philly. And even though it seems like so long ago, once we can kind of get back to everything and normalcy, serving you a double would be my pleasure. I can't wait. So I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And all the best to you. And we'll definitely be in touch.
Alrighty, Sherry. Thank you again.
Thank you. So my guest today has been Eric Adjapong. He is the chef and owner of Pinch and Plate and On the Double. And he was a finalist on Bravo's Top Chef Season 16 and a competitor on Bravo's Top Chef All-Stars Season 17. You can find him at chefadjapong.com, and his other website for his restaurant is eatonthedouble.com. You can find me at Sherry Bayer at Bayer PR and at All Industry. And I should shout out Eric, your social media handle is Chef Adjapong?
Yeah, on Instagram it's Chef Eric Adjapong, and then on Twitter it's just Chef Adjapong.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Make sure people follow him. He's doing a lot of Instagram lives. Check them out. And speaking of which, I am doing an Instagram Live tomorrow. I'm back June 18th at 3 p.m. I'm going to be talking with Randy Fisher. He's the president and founding partner of CREAM, which stands for Culinary Related Entertainment and Marketing. He produces all these big events with South Beach Food and Wine Festival and NYC Food and Wine Festival. So I'm excited to talk with him about the future of events post COVID-19, because that's certainly changing, and it should be a good conversation. So if you guys want to tune in tomorrow at 3 p.m., I'll also save that on IGTV at All Industry. You can check out my Facebook page at All in the Industry for some news. My websites are BayerPublicRelations.com, sherrybayer.com and allintheindustry.com. And all of our shows are archived at heritageradionetwork.org. We are also on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. It's our summer drive at Heritage Radio, and it has been a really tough year for all of us. We're asking for your help now. If you can donate, if you can become a member, we would greatly appreciate it. We are a nonprofit and rely on the support of our listeners. So you could go to our website at heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member. And we have these limited edition bandanas that are perfect face coverings. So, and they're cool if you, that's one of the options in giving support. So thank you in advance. Thanks to my engineer today, Amanda Wang, and thanks again to Eric. I'm Sherry Bayer. Be safe and be well, and thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye. All in the Industry is powered by Simplecast. I'm Sherry Bayer, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.